The meeting of the Energy Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee will come to order. And today we are here to receive a report. Last year we passed legislation that required a biennial greenhouse gas emissions reduction report and an annual greenhouse gas legislative proposal report. And to provide us with that report are William Glahn, Director of the Office of Energy Security, and David Thornton, Assistant Commissioner for the Pollution Control Agency. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senators, staff, my name is Bill Glahn. I am the Director of the Office of Energy Security and a Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce. With me here this afternoon is Assistant Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, David Thornton, and we are pleased that you've invited us here this afternoon to present to the committee our joint report here, which we've entitled Progress in Addressing Climate Change. And as Commissioner Thornton will explain, is actually a combination of, two reports that you had authorized us to complete in statute. So with that, I will turn it over to Commissioner Thornton.
Madam Chair.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Committee members, my name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. First, I'd like to thank you for your consideration in scheduling this meeting around my situation. I really do appreciate that because I very much wanted to be here to help present the report. As Mr. Glahn indicated, this is two reports. It's our biennial greenhouse gas emission reduction report, which is the report that we're to use to track progress towards meeting the emission reduction goals. And then we also have a requirement to submit a report every year that indicates policy options that we think need to be considered. And we have chosen to roll these two reports up into one this year, and probably will do that every other year. This should be familiar to most of you. This came from the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group report. Just as a little bit of a refresher, the blue line is greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, business as usual. Oh, I should say, I'm sorry. In your packets, you should have a copy of our report, and all of the graphs that I'm going to be showing or the charts are also in there as well. The blue line is projected greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, business as usual, and that's projected out into the future from 2005 to 2025. And you can see that without taking any actions, emissions would go up. The red line is projected greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, taking into account existing actions, actions that were on the books at the time that the MCAG was doing its work. And in this case, those are the renewable energy standard, the energy efficiency requirements of the Next Gen Energy Act, the reductions that will be realized through Xcel Energy's metropolitan emission reduction projects at the plants here in the Twin Cities. Those three actions make up the bulk of that difference between the blue line and the red line. And then there are a number of smaller actions that I won't get into, but they include biofuels and a few other things that were on the books back in 2005. The black line, which is also superimposed with the green line, so it's a little hard to distinguish the two. The black line represents the reduction targets of the Next Generation Energy Act. So the line starts in 2015. That represents a 15% reduction from 2005 levels, and it stretches down to 2025, and that point on the graph represents a 30% reduction from 2005 levels. The green line is projected emissions in Minnesota if all of the recommendations that the Climate Change Advisory Group made are implemented, and if the greenhouse gas reductions that were assumed in those recommendations can be realized. So the point of this is to show that there are ways to get to these 15 and 30% reduction targets. This is the graph of greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, the actual emissions based on our emission inventory work. It runs from 1990 to 2006. The 2005 base year estimate that the Next Generation Energy Act reduction targets are based on is indicated with a sort of an orange diamond there. And then we have included the emissions up through 2006. 2006 is the most recent set of data that we have. It takes over a year after the calendar year closes before we have the kinds of information from various sources that are necessary in order to be able to develop the inventory. So while it only shows 2006 right now, we're beginning to accumulate the information needed to put a 2007 estimate together and so forth. What we've done on this graph is also indicate over on the far right side the 2015 target that's set in the Next Gen Energy Act, being a 15% reduction from 2005 levels. And as you can see from this graph, emissions have started to go down in Minnesota. And they've started to go down in approximately a rate that would be needed to try to, if we were to achieve a similar rate of reduction each year, that would be the rate needed to achieve the 2015 goal.
Mr. Thornton, however, that's before we implemented any policy regarding this. Are you suggesting that we were already moving in that direction? I mean, we had passed some renewable energy objectives and some recommendations for conservation, but we hadn't yet passed the RES or the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007.
Madam Chair, there are no doubt a number of things that are responsible for this change in emissions between 2005 and 2006. And as I'll hopefully get into a little bit, I'll indicate what some of the things we know are, but the way that we collect information right now does not allow us to specifically identify reductions associated with particular individual actions. It's one of the things that we need to improve on in building a new inventory system. These are simply the numbers associated with points on that graph. The 2005 baseline is 154 million metric tons of CO2 equivalents. The reduction between 2005 and 2006 represents a 1.2% reduction in emissions. From our inventory, we are able to determine the following things on this chart as to how they contributed to that change in emissions between 2005 and 2006. First of all, the last item listed is electric power generation, and that includes all electricity use throughout all sectors in the state of Minnesota. So electricity use associated with commercial buildings is not reflected up in that top line, the commercial sector. All electricity use is reflected in the, both generation and use is reflected in the bottom line. So one thing that we've seen is that energy use in commercial buildings declined over that period of time. Energy use in residential buildings declined over that period of time. Energy use in industrial settings declined over that time. Greenhouse gas emissions from the agricultural sector declined. We believe due to reduced use of soil nutrients. Emissions from the waste sector declined a little bit, mainly through increased landfill gas capture at landfills and the fact that our landfills are getting older and are generating a little bit less greenhouse gases over time. And there was a pretty significant reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, both from passenger cars and aviation. And as you can see on the last line, an increase in electricity generation and electricity use. And all of that, when you add it all up, translates into about a 1.2% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions over that one-year period of time.
Are these percentages?
Those are not percentages. Those are million metric tons of CO2 equivalent. So that top line would be a reduction of 0.7 million metric tons of CO2 equivalents.
And are you able to convert that into percentages?
We could convert that into percentages.
That would be helpful for us.
Be happy to do that.
But also, I'm not sure I'm following you then, because I thought you just said that we're not able to measure this. So how did we arrive at this then?
We're able to break out these numbers from the different sectors. What we can't tell you is specifically why energy use in commercial buildings dropped. Is it because of the price of natural gas? Is it because of energy efficiency measures that commercial buildings are taking? It's probably a combination of those two things, but we're not able, with the lack of sophistication in our database at this point in time, we're not able to tell you why specifically it reduced. I can speculate a little bit more about the transportation sector. We have, through the MCAG process, MnDOT brought some information to the table there that showed that after around 2000, 2001, vehicle miles traveled in Minnesota stopped increasing and actually flattened out a little bit. And we know that the airline industry has been retrenching a little bit and believe that that probably is reflected in those numbers. So the transportation side of it's a little bit more straightforward. They quit using as much gasoline and jet fuel.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that energy use in the commercial, residential, and industrial sectors has gone down, but overall, maybe there's a distinction between electricity use and energy use. Maybe that's the difference. Are we talking about energy, all forms, transportation energy, as well as electrical energy going down?
Madam
Assistant
Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator Dibble, I should have been a little more clear about this. For the commercial, residential, and industrial sectors, what's reported is energy use in the form of natural gas or heating and processing.
Okay.
Any electricity that is used in the commercial sector is reflected in the bottom line of electrical power generation and electricity use. Transportation associated with the commercial sector would be captured under the transportation line.
Okay. Thank you.
You can continue.
One of the things that we try to accomplish in this report is to give the legislature and any readers a sense of the many activities that are currently underway to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state and how they fit in with the recommendations of the Climate Change Advisory Group. So the bulk of this report, mostly found in the appendix, but summarized earlier on in the report, is essentially an inventory of most, but certainly not all, of the activities underway that are trying to implement the MCAG recommendations and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We wanted to focus for just a few minutes in this presentation on four that we think are particularly important and worth noting.
Madam Chair, I'd like to flip to the next one.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senators, I wanted to highlight some of the activity in two of these sectors, which are renewable energy and conservation. Now, I'm keeping in mind that we were in here a couple of weeks ago where some of my staff people, Mariah White and Jeff Hawes, presented separate reports on those individual subjects. So I'm trying not to rehash the reports you've already heard, but that same information that went into those two reports are reflected in this work that we did jointly with the PCA. But to your earlier question, yeah, you're exactly right. We had not yet passed the 2007 Next Gen Energy Act or the greenhouse gas reduction legislation, but we had, going back a couple of decades, a very active conservation improvement program, and we've been stepping up efforts on that over time. The Renewable Energy Standard, again, passed in 2007, but we had prior to that a renewable energy objective where utilities were required to make a good faith effort to generate power from renewable sources in increasing amounts beginning 2005. So, and as you heard from our report on that subject, the utilities have been making that effort, and some of them are quite ahead of schedule on the objective side of things. So the reduction from 2005 to 2006 is reflecting in part the efforts of the utilities to do more in renewable energy. And we discussed at that earlier hearing about the various percentages that the utilities have to meet under the objective, and now more recently under the standard, different from Xcel because of its head start in renewable energy. Also, we're using the Midwest Renewable Energy Tracking System, MREP system, to keep tabs on renewable energy to make sure we don't have the same energy being counted twice or energy being counted once in Minnesota and elsewhere in another state to make sure that this is distinct projects that we're isolating toward meeting the standard. So we do have that effort underway. And I did want to point out, if I sound like a broken record, that in the last 12 months, that is to date, including a large project in Mower County that came online here in 2009, we've had 428 megawatts of wind generation installed in the state just in the past 12 months, bringing our total to 1,727 megawatts of total installed wind capacity in Minnesota. And again, a substantial increase over the year before. And again, those figures aren't reflected in this work, but just wanting to highlight some of the recent achievements in this area. We have fallen, unfortunately, into fourth place. Texas still leads the country in wind power. Iowa has now surpassed California, as I understand it, to move into second place in wind capacity. California in third, and we are in fourth place. We had been neck and neck with Iowa, but Mr. Buffett's efforts in Iowa have been quite prodigious, and the state has now surpassed us in wind capacity. We still think we have a better basketball team. So we have 1,727 megawatts installed capacity. And flipping to the next slide, on the Conservation Improvement Program, again, we did a report on this. Just highlighting what these numbers mean in 2006, and so those efforts would have been reflected in the results that David discussed in the report before you, but we are saving the equivalent of a baseload 50-megawatt natural gas-fired power plant a year and the carbon emissions that would be associated with that. So, and that was under the old spending standard where utilities had to spend a certain percentage of their revenue on conservation improvement. We have yet to see the results of the change to the 1.5% savings standard. We have one utility, a couple of utilities have come in and put forward plans. It's a 2010 standard. We're expecting quite a few, we're expecting the rest of the utilities to file yet this year as to what their 2010 plans would be. So, it's roughly about half, we're about half the way there so far, and we have a lot more effort to go in that. And so we're looking to renewable energy and conservation improvement, stepping up those programs as ways we'll continue down that glide slope that Commissioner Thornton showed you to get to that 2015 greenhouse gas reduction goal.
What were you referring to when you said that we've saved about the equivalent of a
50 megawatt? These numbers, Madam Chair, if I may, these, when you look at just the 2006 line on there, row that 2006, how many kilowatt hours, how many tons of CO2 equivalent saved on the electric and then the natural gas side, I don't relate very well to those numbers. So I try to put it in terms that I can relate to, and hopefully the members will as well. And I think of the power plant that my former employer built in Chaska, Minnesota, a 50-megawatt power plant, to serve maybe 40,000 homes, and something of that size is the equivalent of energy savings that we produce through the utilities and their conservation improvement programs for the year 2006.
But did you say the equivalent of a coal-powered?
Natural gas. I meant to say natural gas. If I said coal, I apologize. I meant to say natural gas.
Like, which would be equivalent to how many megawatts?
50.
And you're saying that we've set a goal of 1.5% decrease annually?
Right.
And Mr. Thornton said that we're meeting about 1.2. Is that correct?
We're reducing 1.2% of the tonnage. I'm not quite sure it's a one-to-one comparison, but assuming that we can do a comparison of those apples and oranges, and
it's hard to follow.
It is hard to follow, and I don't think I'm really helping in my explanation here. What happened in 2006, but we believe that continuing on the path we're on in meeting the renewable energy standard, continuing on the path we're on and the conservation improvement program, continuing on what Commissioner Thornton's going to talk about in our waste management and some of our other efforts, along with the recommendations we make later in the report, we're feeling fairly good at this point about meeting the 2015 deadline. Nothing's written in stone, and I'm kind of jumping to the conclusion here. We may well come before you in the future to ask for more initiatives.
And you think you're going to meet that by renewable energy increase and conservation improvement?
That's part of it. I don't think I am saying that we're going to get all the way there just on those two, but they're two of the bigger pieces of the puzzle.
Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, one of the 15%. Highest opportunities identified in the Climate Change Advisory Group report for reducing greenhouse gas emissions related to waste management. And if you look at both the front end and back end of the waste management system and add those two opportunities together, it's the third highest potential greenhouse gas reduction option. Of greater than 9 million metric tons per year by 2025. So we felt like this was an opportunity that we needed to move on at the Pollution Control Agency. We had we were in the process of finishing up our solid waste policy report last year. At the same time, the Climate Change Advisory Group recommendations came out, and we took that opportunity to sync the recommendations of that report with the MCAG recommendations. And what's resulted is that we've established a integrated solid waste management stakeholder group to look into this and see what we can do in all aspects of waste management, the waste management process, to try to achieve significant, substantial, and additional reductions in greenhouse gases from that sector. The group is meeting now and will be ultimately recommending actions that will be needed and the likelihood of succeeding with those actions. They're scheduled to complete their work in June of this year, and they're looking at the usual list of waste management items: reducing, reusing, recycling, composting, landfill gas, and waste to energy. Finally, we wanted to talk a little bit about adaptation and response. It's not something that folks typically like to hear about, but if you, you believe what many scientists are telling us, and that the climate is already warming to some degree and it may not be possible to reverse it completely, we need to be prepared for this. And just to give you an indication of a few of the things that are ongoing at the moment, the Department of Health is looking at potential public health impacts associated with climate change and what some appropriate response options might be. And by public health impacts, I'm referring to things like additional heat stress issues and infectious diseases that might result as the climate warms. The PCA and DNR are realigning some of the monitoring that we do to track temperature-related and climate-related impacts to forests, waters, and wildlife. And the Department of Transportation and other departments that use this kind of information are looking at updating climate data for planning and engineering purposes. If we're going to build something to withstand a 100-year flood, we need to make sure we're looking at the appropriate 100-year flood. And future 100-year floods may be a little bit different than what we have typically been planning for in the past. And in the report, on page 24 and 25, we have 14 policy recommendations that we have outlined for consideration and implementation in the near term. And we decided not to go through them individually here, but we're certainly able to answer any questions that committee members may have.
Where are these policy recommendations on page 24?
They begin at the bottom of page 24 and continue on page 25 of the report.
Madam Chair, under letter B, there's the matrix, and there's a single bullet point on page 24, and on page 25 are the remaining bullet points. A little pagination problem there, I think.
Okay. In the first part of the report.
At that. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm catching up a little slowly here. I apologize for that. I'm just absorbing what you said, Mr. Glenn. And so can I go back for a second before we get to the policy recommendations? Or I'm not sure who went through the whole, if it was both of you, went through this about I heard you say that we're on track to meet our goal of 15% reduction by 2015. One of you said that. Sorry, Mr. Thornton. Whatever. And, okay, first of all, in terms of, you said you don't have a percentage of where we're at right now, but in the text it says that it's declined emissions, total greenhouse gas emissions have declined about 2 million CO2 equivalent short tons. I don't know what short tons are, but and out of a total of 152 million, so that's a little over 1%, you know, between 1 and 1.5%, right? So can we make that equivalent? Is that an apple and an orange, or is that?
Madam Chair.
Just one moment. Senator Anderson, where are you reading that?
I'm looking at page 4, just the introductory paragraph under the Roman numeral 3, where it says, between 2005 and 2006, greenhouse gas emissions from Minnesota sources declined by about 2 million CO2 equivalent short tons. Is that the same as a million tons?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson.
Deputy Commissioner.
Trying to dig myself out of the hole I dug a little earlier. I think I was a little too agreeable. The 1.2% and the approximately 2 million tons, whether they're metric or short, are apples and apples. That 1.2% is reflecting tons of CO2 equivalent. Now, the 1.5% is a whole different thing, and I can't go and say if we save 1.5% of electricity is only part of total, only one source of greenhouse gas emissions, and then it depends on what that mix is, you know, of how we make it, whether it's natural gas or coal or nuclear, et cetera. So I apologize to the committee for misspeaking and trying to draw an equivalence where there is none. So we cannot draw an equivalence that saying we'll reduce by 1.5% on electricity use, which is only part of the greenhouse gas story, that'll get us to where we need to get alone on the greenhouse gas reduction targets.
Okay.
My mistake.
Well, no, that's okay.
Senator
I wasn't
Anderson.
Thinking about the 1.5% so much as just a big picture here is, and I think you're agreeing that this is about a little over 1% reduction, 1.3% reduction in overall greenhouse gas emissions. So that's going in the right direction. But then in your table two, it shows that all the reductions are coming from everything except electricity. And I thought I heard you say you don't know what accounts for those reductions. In some of the areas you do and some you don't. But it seems to me that the only ones that we have policies that we've referenced are in the electric area. And so the only policies we've passed specifically, at least the ones we've talked about, that have reduced, we can attribute reductions to, are the ones that are having an increase. And all the other areas that are decreasing, we don't know why or if there's anything we've done or not done that's reduced them. Did I get that wrong?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, no, I don't think you, well, I would just fill in that that I again, the table, which has the somewhat confusing numbers in them, the first few items are natural gas. And we have had policies to reduce natural gas through conservation improvement program, home weatherization, all those activities. I would call them policies that we have in those areas that we've strengthened through increasing it to a 1.5% energy savings goal later than these data would reflect. So we have had policies in those areas. And then I'm not as familiar with the waste sector or the ag sector just because I don't deal in that, or the transportation sector. You know, stuff like cars, as they get more fuel efficient, that would help with that as well. I would think it's a fair characterization that much of the activity that we've engaged in has focused on the electric power sector. And again, the 1.5%, I know I keep harping on this, but you could continue to grow overall electricity usage, but it's the 1.5% on a growing base. So it's, if you were to add a new big load to a utility, that would increase its overall sales, and that increases the base, increases the 1.5% target, and stepping down from that. But even if we continue to save 1.5% a year, we could have underlying growth. And so you see a number you commonly see for, you know, in normal economic times is perhaps a 2% overall growth in electricity usage, which reflects population growth, reflects increase in number of households and businesses, increased economic activity, increased usage in people buying TV, bigger TVs, et cetera. So what we're hoping to do is get something close to a net zero by having this 1.5% increase. At least that's still how I look at it.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Anderson.
I think really the point I was trying to make in this, looking at the slide, shows this is our first reduction in a long time. But I don't see that we know why it's being reduced. That's kind of my overall concern is that we're really, I mean, we know what we're doing in electricity. We can measure that more specifically. But we're not sure why the reduction has really occurred. And so that makes me a little nervous to say we're on track for those reductions to continue from now till 2015 if we really don't know what's driving those reductions. Why do we have any basis to think that they will continue to decline year after year?
Assistant Commissioner Thornton.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I think you're exactly right. We need to collect better data to be able to connect the dots between the reductions or whatever we find when we do the total inventory and what is the driver or the drivers for the numbers that we're seeing. For some of these sectors, it's going to be a little bit easier than others, but we've listed literally dozens of actions that are underway here in this report, yet we can't tell you what good they're doing, unfortunately. And that's a problem, and that's something that we need to address as we move ahead. And we certainly don't want to leave you with the impression that we think everything's fine and we're going to meet that 2015 goal without doing anything else, because that's not true. And we need to continue to come to you each year with new ideas and new things to examine and explore and implement to keep making progress as we move ahead. But it is nice to see that we've maybe turned the corner.
Other questions or comments? Okay. Did you want to go through those policy recommendations? And will you be bringing us legislation regarding these?
Wow, look at that. There you go.
Madam Chair, Senators, we'd be happy to go through them. And
Deputy Commissioner?
The answer, I think, is going to vary by specific bullets. Some of these we anticipate will have legislation associated with them. Others are internal efforts, internal to the administration. Others might be legislation that senators or representatives introduce of their own accord to help direct us in our efforts. So the first one, I don't want to keep rehashing this, is I've already covered this a couple of times. We're going to continue the 2010 goal of this beginning to have every utility save the 1.5%. And I would anticipate there'll be legislation, if there hasn't been, I think there might be already, about what can count toward that 1.5%, et cetera, and the renewable energy standard, and there's perennial legislation having to do with that. Moving on to page 25, I think I'll hand it back to Commissioner Thornton.
Madam Chair, the next three relate to motor vehicles. The first one we talk about continuing to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from transportation fuels, and we specifically call out continuing efforts to implement the E20 requirements. Getting more vehicles using E85, continuing to implement the B20 requirements, and trying to make our fuels in the state with a lower carbon footprint. Connected to this, I should point out that the Department of Commerce Office of Energy Security has a grant with the University of Minnesota Humphrey Institute to do a study on low-carbon fuel standards and how that might work into this situation here in Minnesota, and we'll be getting the results of that study, I think, in September. The next item we talk about, Minnesota should advocate for federal regulations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. We've seen that the new administration is taking a more aggressive approach to greenhouse gases in general and has already announced some measures on motor vehicle emissions, and we're hopeful that they'll take a more aggressive approach there even still. And then the last one in this grouping is that we should begin getting ready for electric vehicles. And here we're suggesting that we look at what kind of electricity infrastructure is needed in order to support recharging electric vehicles or plug-in hybrid electric vehicles.
Madam Chair, if I could interject on that.
Deputy Commissioner.
I had the privilege of attending a meeting with Senator Dibble, who I see has stepped out, and Representative Hornstein on this very subject, where they were discussing with some of us a proposed legislation. They had some very good ideas in there about what kind of infrastructure and how do we get it put in place so cars, plug-in hybrids or pure electric vehicles would have opportunities to plug in at a parking meter or a parking ramp, and what kind of regulations or legislation or ordinances we would need around the state to have that happen. Google announced a couple of days ago that they would like to get into what's termed the smart grid business, and mentioned electric cars in particular. This is an interesting idea that you have your cell phone, and when your cell phone is turned on, then the cell phone company knows where you're at and knows where tower you're near, so they can ring your phone if somebody's trying to reach you. Well, in the brave new world of the future, that the internet would know whether your car was plugged into the grid somewhere and would know whether the battery was low or needed recharging. So we believe, just by doing back-of-the-envelope type calculations, that with the existing electrical transmission infrastructure and the existing electric generation infrastructure, we have adequate capacity to put in large numbers of electric vehicles or plug-in hybrid vehicles on the grid. But people are saying that because they believe that this recharging would occur at night. If everybody were to go home at 5 o'clock in the evening, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the evening, and the instinct is you get home from your commute and you plug your car into the socket and want to recharge right then. Well, for a lot of utilities, 5 to 6 p.m. in the evening happens to be their peak time. So the smart grid or some technology we would hope would be available, we'd have the infrastructure to accommodate it, that would know that even though you've plugged in your electric or plug-in hybrid into the wall, that it won't start recharging until the grid has spare capacity and it's an opportune time, price-wise and reliability-wise to do it. So those are the sort of things we had in mind when we were saying that we should look into infrastructure needs. I don't know if we were something we were going to do internally or if Senator Dibble or others have legislation they'd like to introduce. We'd be happy to take a look at that and work with members.
Okay. Madam Chair, I think I'll take the next three and then hand it back to Mr. Glahn. The fourth bullet down on the page relates to cap and trade and participation in the Midwest Governor's Greenhouse Gas Reduction Accord. Obviously, a lot of people are interested in seeing what the results of that will be. I believe the last meeting of the group has been scheduled for March, and I'm working on the work group that's drafting the model rule, and we're targeting trying to get a model rule out by September. The next item says that we should continue efforts identified by the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative Task Force to identify sound, efficient, and cost-effective methods to achieve reductions through land management activities. This is a group that has made some recommendations to DNR regarding developing an inventory of lands where carbon is currently sequestered and potentially in danger of being released for various reasons like fire or development, and for looking further into the options that they could incorporate into their management techniques to be able to sequester carbon, additional carbon in forest soils and other things. And then the next one we've already talked about a bit. The agency, the PCA, should continue the development, because we've sort of started this, of a comprehensive greenhouse gas emissions and tracking inventory system that can be appropriately integrated with anything that EPA is going to announce or develop in the next few months. And this relates to the data problems that we were talking about earlier. We need to have a formal emission inventory system and one that allows us to track the reductions and increases associated with various activities that are being taken in the state.
Madam Chair, Senators, I'm going to go through the remainder fairly quickly because each of them is either controversial enough on their own or there's sufficient interest in these individual ones that I think a more thorough discussion is warranted at some later time. But I just want to mention them. Lifting the statutory ban on new nuclear facilities. Again, as far as I know, no one's planning on building a nuclear plant here. There are no plans on the drawing board. Of course, with the ban, nobody would put in the effort, I would think. But the idea is, by lifting the ban, you send a signal to folks that all options are on the table, that perhaps we never have another plant built in the state, or we don't continue to keep the current ones open. Who knows? But I'd like to send a signal to other utilities, developers out there, that all options are open as we move forward. And if somebody has a new, smaller footprint, less waste generating, and more efficient facility, which these newer plans are, we should take a look at them.
Mr. Glahn, along those lines, we're devoting the first week of March to looking at proposals for removing the moratorium on nuclear energy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make a note of that. A number of bills have already been introduced, as you're aware. The next one, the appliance standards. Again, we don't want to get in the business of being the laboratory or the testing facility because we're a small state and there are many other states that are also interested in the same thing. But the idea is the feds only do so many appliances, and if states get together and do other appliances, that we could tag along with them and adopt common standards where the federal government hasn't taken action. And as I recall, if I recall correctly from the MCAC report, that was one of the biggest potentials out there for greenhouse gas reductions. And if the committee would indulge me a moment, we've been in some meetings recently where we talked about this, and I haven't seen one, so I'm interested to find one, this kilometer, where it's a device that you plug into the wall. I was looking for a plug. You plug it into the wall, and then you plug a device into it. It's almost like a power strip or something like that, and you let it go for a day, and you record how much power a device is consuming even when it's been off for a whole day. So it's amazing, a flat-screen TV or a computer, a printer, how much power it's used even when it's in the off mode. And so it's awareness of devices like the kilometer, standards where we can do a lot for reducing electricity usage just by changing how appliances are designed and manufactured and how we use them in our homes. And I think there has been one or more bills in this area introduced. Let's see. I won't dwell on the next one because I know we're going to take up seabed next week. But and I've said on a number of occasions that the seabed only solves half the problem. It doesn't solve the problem of the price and who pays for it. We think there are ideas around community energy and green pricing that we can promote some of these projects. And I mentioned, perhaps I didn't mention, we put in 117 megawatts of seabed projects in the last year. So we're making progress in seabed. We think there are approaches and models out there that would help us do more with seabed without having negative effects on ratepayers and reliability. But I'll save my editorializing for some other day. And moving on to the next one, we are going to continue internally our efforts to coordinate our green job and clean technology promotion activities. Actually, these next three are all fairly related. The governor, and we mentioned this before, his Green Jobs Investment Initiative. Those bills will be coming, will be introduced at some near date. And with the stimulus and all the activity around that, we're trying to maximize a number of things at once with these initiatives, which is to create jobs, create them as quickly as possible, stimulate the economy as quickly as we can, given our restrictions on funding and contracts and our due diligence as good managers of public money, but also promoting our environmental interest in reducing emissions, global greenhouse, whatever, in as best manner we can. So those three or four bullets there are all part of an ongoing effort to coordinate those across our state agencies. And we've also been in front of you talking about the B3 efforts with our buildings. And there have been a number of executive orders issued by the governor over the years in this area. We're looking at consolidating that and rolling out useful tools for building and property managers at the state, county, and local levels through this tool we've developed, the B3 tool. So with that, Madam Chair, I think we're complete.
Well, a number of things. You have a number of proposals here, but I'm wondering, do we need to implement all of them in order to stay on target and meet our goals as we move forward? And if so, should we be passing legislation now to do that?
Madam Chair.
While you're thinking about it, I mean, there are a couple of big elephants sitting out here that nobody's talked about, and that's the two power plants that are sitting out there that potentially may be built. How does that impact our decisions as we move forward? And then a third one, of course, would be the SIP. If power companies are having a hard time meeting the 1.5 mandated SIP, and it sounds to me like we need to meet that requirement in order to stay on target, then are you compelling them in some way to meet that? Or just seems like there are a lot of unanswered questions here.
Madam Chair, I think it's safe to say that we believe that we'll need to implement all of these things in one form or another and more beyond that to meet these greenhouse gas reduction goals. many of these items don't require legislation. Some of them do. And as Mr. Glahn suggested, there are already a number of bills that have been introduced that address some of these different things. So it's a mix of things. It sort of the legislature gets to decide whether you want to take these up as legislative initiatives or leave it to the departments to implement.
I think we were looking for some direction about how we're sure we're going to stay on target and what specific steps we need to make, because we passed this legislation. In order for it to be meaningful, we have to meet those goals. And I know you've put a lot of effort into this, but I'm not sure that really it's enough for us at this point.
Madam Chair, I've done a lot of thinking about this, and in particular looking back at the legislation that requires an enforceable plan. I can't remember the number of it at the moment. We're all still in a learning mode about how to do this, and probably the only approach that could be taken that would provide certainty towards meeting these goals would be a cap and trade program. And everyone's interested in that. There seems to be more interest in doing it nationally or regionally than as an individual state for cost reasons. And we're continuing to try to make progress on that. A lot of these other items are complementary measures to something like that. And in many cases, it's just not possible to know exactly what benefits we'll see from doing some of these things until we try them and see how well they work. So we're making progress, and we're learning as we go along, and we're going to have to exercise, I think, adaptive management in moving forward. Some of the things that the MCAG report recommends are probably not going to pan out the way they thought, and some of them probably won't get implemented because they're just not particularly popular, like reducing the speed limit, for example. In answer to your second question, when we had a hearing earlier on this with House members present, I believe Representative Wagenius asked about those two new power plants that are proposed and how they fit into the whole picture. And I went back and had a discussion with the expert that helped us develop the energy forecast for the Climate Change Advisory Group, and he walked me through a lot of data that was generated by the group. They did analyze a scenario with and without those two plants, and this is going to be counterintuitive for us, but the forecast showed that if those plants were built and came online, greenhouse gas emissions would actually be a little bit lower than if they weren't built. And the reason for that is because when those plants come online, older, less efficient plants would be turned off or would be used to generate power for somebody other than Minnesota. And so the carbon footprint for Minnesota alone isn't really changed dramatically. That's just a piece of the story about the issues associated with those two plants, and I'm sure the committee members know what many of the other issues are. But from a forecast standpoint, solely looking at Minnesota's responsibilities for electrical generation, it didn't make a huge difference, at least in the way that they projected the emissions.
And what about the SIP? It seems to me that you're relying a lot on the Renewable Energy Standard and the Conservation Improvement Program to meet those goals.
Madam Chair, members, I think that's a fair fair assessment. We listed it as our top two opportunities for reducing greenhouse gases. But when we look at what we've accomplished in getting projects on the renewable side, if we looked at what we've accomplished in getting projects in the ground, I mentioned the 428 megawatts in the past 12 months. We've over a megawatt of solar projects that we have installed now. And we have several hundred more megawatts of renewable power projects in the pipeline at some stage of the permitting and planning process. We have thousands of megawatts of power plant projects, some 400 projects by number in the MISO queue that are at various stages of planning. And that's probably not even including all the potential of North and South Dakota to add to it. The renewable power is there. We have people willing to bring it online. And back to Senator Anderson's question from a couple of hearings ago, at prices that we don't think are too much higher than what we're paying today for more traditional sources. And so we have a high degree of confidence we're going to continue along the path of meeting the renewable energy standard without having to take advantage of those off-ramps that we wrote into the legislation. On the SIP side, I think people are a little less certain about their ability to meet that. We have had one utility come through the process and give us a plan we think is doable to meet the 1.5% requirement for 2010. Other utilities are working on their plans. They have expressed reservations. But until I see the plans, until I see application in front of me, we won't know for sure. But notwithstanding the concerns, I still feel, I don't think it's the case if we get to 1.49%, we're going to be completely off, and we're not going to be even close. But I think we're going to get far enough along with the progress we've already made and with some of the new technologies that are coming along that I'd characterize, and perhaps Commissioner Thornton would want to put this some more nuance. I think we have the tools in our toolkit for the next few years. And stuff like the nuclear power ban lifting, let's face it, nobody has a plan on the table. If they started today, it wouldn't be here in 10 years. So it's not going to help us meet the 2015 deadline. So a lot of this stuff is long-term stuff that we want to start having the conversation about. We'd like to have the conversation this year to get the ball rolling. And maybe, so I'm not saying there's a crisis if we don't implement this all in 2009, but we'd like to, these are the ideas we have. We'd like to keep them moving forward. Maybe we can get them implemented in 10 and 11, and we'd have more tools in our toolkit. So when we're getting near meeting our RES standard, when utilities are to the getting closer to the 1 and 1.5% rules, that we'll have these new tools in our toolkit. So I feel a sense of urgency, but I don't feel a sense of panic. We have tools in our toolkit. We have a fair amount of confidence that we'll continue on that path that Commissioner Thornton showed us earlier. But we would like to continue the conversation around these items. And we think these show the most promise and the ones we'd like to continue discussing with you.
I think I am concerned about some of these things being rather nebulous. Like we talk a lot about advocacy and investigating and continuing and pursuing incentives, which I agree with you. But they don't give me a lot of confidence that we're going to be able to meet those goals at this point. So I'm hearing from you that you feel like we're on target. Also, the landfill group is still meeting, and the Midwest Governors Association is still meeting on the cap and trades issue, which won't be completed until after session is finished this year. So could we anticipate that we will have legislation next year on those two issues?
Madam Chair, we're obligated to come back every year with a list of policy options. So I would anticipate that we'll have some new and different ones on our list next year when we're here speaking to you.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other day when we were talking about the low carbon standards, there's the E20 waiver we're waiting for, if I remember correctly. My question, I guess, is that something that the Office of Energy Security or someone can help move that forward so we're not waiting for 5 or 6 years out? I don't know when that was scheduled to, we're actually going to see this waiver. Is there things that we can do to move that forward more quickly?
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, the Department of Agriculture is taking the lead on the E20 work, and they just recently issued a report that I can get in your hands if you'd like, that lays out the schedule that they see for completing the work necessary and for, I think, submitting a waiver request to EPA in around 2010, if I remember correctly. But I'd be happy to get a copy of that report to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I go to that? You were, Mr. Thornton, you were talking about a study on the two new proposed coal plants that you asked about, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Who did that study that you were referencing?
Assistant Commissioner Thornton.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, it was the Climate Change Advisory Group Energy Supply Technical Work Group. And they worked through all of that and made some assumptions about when the plants would come online and approved some assumptions about what would be backed off or how that analysis would be done.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, so it was part
Senator
of the MCAG
Anderson.
Group. I'm sorry I missed that part. So what really surprised me was the conclusion. I mean, we have a number here that we've reduced emissions by 2 million tons. And I know Big Stone alone would add 4 or 5 million tons of CO2. So it really surprises me that they would say it wouldn't have any impact, because either we'd shut old plants, which means we really don't need that new power, or we'd sell it somewhere else, which means the emissions would still be increased. We just wouldn't have to count them.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I think you got it right.
Okay. Can I just ask, Madam Chair, one more question?
Senator Anderson.
I'm just looking at a couple of the policy ideas here. In particular, Minnesota should consider adopting appliance standards where there are not federal standards, and investigate new models for community development of renewable energy to promote local ownership. Will you have any initiatives on this, or are you supporting any initiatives in this area, this session?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the short answer is yes, but I'd rather discuss them in those individual fora, when we have an actual proposal in front of us. But, if you like, I could talk a little bit about these, if you will indulge me.
Actually, I have introduced bills for both a registry and also for appliance standard, too.
Oh, good.
So.
Okay. I didn't realize that, Madam Chair, and I hadn't seen that. And what about the local ownership of renewable energy community development? Is that a bill that you've...
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, it's not a bill that I've... but I mentioned to you that bill that the person who's now the speaker had introduced mm-hmm. about 5 years ago when Mike Bull was working over there. And that, to me, was an interesting idea of having a community-based cooperative ownership. It might be somewhat controversial. I like to use the community-based agriculture or the community-supported agriculture model, where you have people who are supporting it as consumers and as owners. You have both sides of it, where we usually think of stuff like seabed as having ownership opportunities. But we've had this green pricing program in for many, many years. If I remember correctly, and I could be not remembering it correctly, predated even or was contemporary with the renewable energy objective. And again, perhaps not a great analogy, and again, I'm not endorsing the idea, but we've had a lot of discussion about the blender pumps. The idea is somebody could dial how much ethanol they wanted, how much gasoline they wanted. But we have programs where, in place, the renewable energy standard pretty much says that everybody's going to buy 25% renewables. We have green pricing programs where people can buy 100% renewables through a wind program or whatever. And wouldn't it be nice to calibrate something in between if somebody wanted to pay more for something than the 25% we've mandated, or something less than the 100% they have under some of these programs, or you go and subscribe to a particular program or a particular project that's near your town or something like that, which you can do if you're a co-op or a muni. And, you know, there's lots of other models of doing it where a municipal utility would perhaps have a citizen referendum about putting up a wind tower, and then everybody would agree and buy into it through their utility. But just trying to think outside the box of how can we promote community, your term, democratization of energy production. How can we promote that without some of the negative effects of some of these approaches, which is higher rates for ratepayers who don't necessarily are able to support those higher prices, or the reliability concerns about placing stuff where, you know, wherever. So I'm trying to be creative here, trying to think outside the box. I'd refer you, and I think I have referred at least some of you to that bill that the speaker put in before she was the speaker, which was a distributed renewable energy cooperative model, something worth talking about.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, this is a great report. It's exciting to see that carbon emissions actually went down. And, you know, I'm looking forward to learning more over time, you know, about, you know, what sorts of actions and activities are attributable to that. Clearly, some of it came about as a result of some specific policy actions. Some of it came about just because of, you know, prevailing changes that we probably don't have much to do with, probably conditions in the marketplace. I appreciate the list of policy recommendations. Backing up just a little bit from that, looking at the chart, the grid, and I might have stepped out of the room for a second when you touched on that. I'm just trying to interpret the right hand column, the legislative recommendations. Are these the position of the administration, of the executive branch, or not, or just an analysis and a review of them? The reason I ask that is because, Mr. Thornton, you said that, you know, you're going to be coming back in future years with additional recommendations and the like. I just observe in the list of policy recommendations, most of which I like a lot, with the same concerns that the chair has, that they may be a little ambiguous, but I see a big lack of focus on some, you know, in particular, one of the major contributors to greenhouse gases, that's the transportation sector, 24%. We had a hearing on that yesterday. You know, we touch on it a little bit in the fuels, federal regulations, but again, that's pretty nebulous. And, you know, electric vehicles, but even those aren't going to get us there. I think the recommendations of the Climate Change Action Group talk about some other things, and I see there's some analysis of that. So are we going to take additional look, or are some of those opportunities foreclosed? Is that how we can interpret that right-hand column?
Madam Chair, Senator
Assistant
Dibble.
Commissioner.
The Green Solutions Act required us, I think that's where it was, this statute was located, requires us to come back with legislative recommendations every year, and for the actions that were recommended by MCAG. And if we don't have a legislative or a policy recommendation, we're to explain why we don't. So we use this chart, this long table, to list every single one of the Climate Change Advisory Group recommendations by category, give a little bit of an update on what's going on right now in the progress status column. Ideally, we'd like to have a column that says tons of greenhouse gases reduced as a result of these actions, but we're not there yet. We've talked about that. And then in the last column is whether or not we are at this point in time thinking that there's some new policy option that needs to be considered or implemented. And for some of them, we didn't feel like now was the time for various reasons. In some cases, more research is needed or more study, or we wanted to find out what was going to happen at the national level. And then for the others, we made a short list of 14 items that we've been talking about. And it is because this report is required annually, it's our intention to go back and review this list every year and and add to the recommendations as appropriate.
So,
Senator Devlin.
So, Madam Chair, I'll take that as good news that the right-hand column is not the final word. Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Kevendall.
Madam Chair, and just maybe a clarification for Senator Dibble, I have seen this chart several times. I have a bill, actually, that addresses one of the issues, a minor one, but I have seen another column that does have a governor's recommendation on it. Maybe, I don't know where I got it, but I got it. I've seen it several times. So there are other charts floating. Maybe you got it right there.
I do.
Yeah, you do. So I don't know. I think there are some recommendations floating around out there.
Senator John Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask about the cap and trade here. I mean, it seems to me is that what I'm getting the feeling is that we want to wait until the federal government does something or is a regional approach is reached, and yet even the Midwest Governors Association, which was supposed to have recommendations by this point, is kind of faltering and stumbling along, and I think there's a lot of backtracking. Are we now starting to maybe put into the conversation, at least in the circles that you're working with, possibility of just a straight carbon tax instead of cap and trade, or what direction is this going now?
Assistant Commissioner Thornton.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, for a number of years, I heard no conversations about carbon tax at the national level. And everything was about cap and trade. But having spent the better part of the last 2 years in various stakeholder groups talking about how to do a cap and trade program, it's really complicated. And there is a certain simplicity associated with a carbon tax. And I understand that people at the national level are beginning to talk about it again for those very reasons. But I do believe that what we'll see first nationally will probably be some sort of a cap and trade program. And we'll have to, I know EPA is working on it, and we'll have to wait and see what they've got in mind.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, as you're aware, that you've attended a number of these MGA meetings, as has Senator Anderson and other legislators. It's tough going. You know, there are lots of very complex, very controversial issues, and Commissioner Thornton has much more experience in this than I do. But from my limited experience, the meetings I've been to, measurable progress is made every meeting. Not as fast as a lot of people in the room would like it to be, and as I mentioned yesterday, that some of these issues, they might seem very esoteric, very, you know, inside baseball. Should we auction allowances? Should we give them away for free? Something like that. And whole industries will live and die on the decision that's made. So we're trying to be very deliberate about the way we move forward, not causing large-scale economic disruptions, not causing large-scale hardships, not punishing the innocent, as we discussed yesterday, or rewarding the guilty, or whatever we're trying to accomplish or not accomplish. But, I think from my own experience, I think people you're starting to hear stuff about a carbon tax because it's a simple solution. You just say, here it is, it's cents per whatever, or percent of that, whereas it doesn't require this entire infrastructure that has to be worked out. And so, you know, it's taking longer than we had originally planned, that had been laid out in our timetables. We're continuing to make progress. We should have some modeling in advance of the next meeting. We have the next meeting scheduled. We hope to have something coming out late summer, early fall. In the meantime, we know stuff's going on in Washington, that there's been lots of discussions at doing something at the federal level. And one of my personal hopes is that our Midwest efforts, even if they get preempted by something at the federal level, that our experience, because the Midwest is very different than the East Coast or the West Coast or the southern tier states, that our experiences and our imperatives will be included in any kind of national program if that comes out. So I honestly don't think I've seen any kind of wavering in the commitment to going forward with the effort. It's just a recognition of how much is to be done. We've accomplished a lot. We still have a lot to go, and
committed to going forward to completing the effort. But, you know, it could well be where we'll be overtaken by events at some point.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I do have a bill to that actually relates to this, and I'm going to turn the meeting over to Senator Dahl.
Senate File 444.
Thank Senator Prettner-Soler. This bill, actually, as you heard the Assistant Commissioner state, there were many difficulties in being able to identify where savings were occurring and to be able to measure that accurately. So this bill does relate to the measurement of greenhouse gas emissions from stationary facilities. And it is a start in developing an inventory for our state so that from year to year we will be able to identify where the reductions occur. This information is critical in making informed policy decisions to reduce our emissions and monitor the impacts of those MCAG initiatives that we have legislated. And this is a legislation that originally was a recommendation of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, and it received unanimous consent from them. Basically, it's a greenhouse gas registry that we are requiring the PCA to establish and maintain, and it will enable recording of greenhouse gas emission reductions in a central repository that will help us identify this will help us identify strategies for mitigating those emissions. Very simple bill. I understand that there will not be a fiscal note on it because it's already part of the PCA budget request, and so there should not be a fiscal note on it. But actually, the Assistant Commissioner is here to address the bill, and I would like to call, Mr. Chair, with your agreement, Assistant Commissioner David Thornton, and also Chuck Dayton is here from the MK group to address it, and Mike Franklin from the chamber.
Okay. Senator, who would you like to speak first?
The Assistant Commissioner.
Okay. Welcome again, Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, David Thornton from the Pollution Control Agency. I just wanted to say that Senator Prettner-Soler's bill clarifies the authority that we have to move forward with rules to require a greenhouse gas emission inventory system. It recognizes the data management issues and needs that we have to overcome in order to do that. And it provides us the flexibility to make sure that whatever we develop is something that can be integrated in with what we suspect EPA is in the process of developing as well, as a national emission inventory, possibly not quite as comprehensive as we might want, but at least so that we're not duplicating effort on these things. And as Senator Prettner-Soler said, the governor's budget recommendation for the PCA includes a funding shift within the Environmental Fund to provide $1.4 million for us to use to develop a new emission inventory system, not just for greenhouse gases, but for the other air pollutants that we sorely need. And we very much want to include and incorporate greenhouse gases into that.
Assistant Commissioner, if I could ask you just two questions, I guess. One is, do you have a time frame at which do you hope to have this developed by?
Mr. Chair, the would probably take a couple of years, and that's why the funding that we've asked for is $700,000 in each year of the biennium.
Okay. And my second question is, in reading through this and the reporting system design, just so I understand, and maybe others know already, but on 1.2 of the bill here, it says stationary sources of emissions above a specified level should include most, if not all, the stationary sources of emissions above a specified level. What is stationary sources of emissions? What are you referring to there?
Mr. Chair, that's a term of art in the air quality field to basically mean things like power plants and factories. And the reason it says above a certain level is because states are looking at what the appropriate cutoff is for sources that need to be reporting versus sources that don't. And that's something we're still wrestling with as to just exactly where to draw that line.
Okay. Assistant Commissioner, Senator Brettner Solon.
Stationary is as opposed to vehicles like cars and trucks.
On that point, is the B3 inventory that was done over these past few years on buildings, did they do any of that reporting as well in terms of any kind of carbon emissions?
Mr. Chairman, the buildings that the B3 effort is associated with would not be considered stationary sources in an inventory like this, but we do need to account for the emissions from those kinds of sources, whether they're commercial buildings or institutions, government buildings, or even people's homes. And that's one of the things that we need to sort out and work out in this inventory system. The B3 tool would provide a way for the data to be collected so that those kinds of sources could report. The question is, do we want them to report, or is there a better way to collect the emissions information from those kinds of sources? And those are the kind of things that we need to sort out over the next year or two.
Thank you. Okay.
So,
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm following your questions here. If we define this as stationary sources, is that a defined term in statute? I mean, will that limit who could report under this if it becomes law?
Assistant Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Fuller should weigh in on this. Okay. As I read it, I did not interpret it as limiting.
Mr. Fuller,
where we could go with this.
Well, just to
Senator
frame
Anderson.
My question, Mr. Chair, I thought I heard you say that those state buildings that are being audited would not be considered stationary sources. And they don't move, but there must be some other reason they're not considered. They're not permanent. I'm not sure what your definition is.
Assistant Commissioner, do you want to try that still, or you want to have Mr. Fuller try
it? I will, briefly. Yes. I don't know that stationary sources are defined in Minnesota statutes. And I honestly don't know if they're specifically defined in EPA regulations. But the way the term is applied is typically sources, industrial sources or boilers and things like that, that do have permits. Mm-hmm. Commercial buildings and homes and other kinds of buildings are classified as area sources and generally do not have permits from us. But nevertheless, and this is one of the things that's so different about doing a greenhouse gas inventory than doing an inventory for traditional pollutants. Mm-hmm. Our emission inventory for criteria pollutants, the sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide, we require people to report to us and certify their emissions to us, and that pretty much constitutes the inventory. Here we need to look at homes. We need to definitely look at transportation sources. We need to look at agriculture sources. We need to look at all of them. And so the data structure system that we need to do that has to be a lot different than what we're currently using, and that's why we need to rebuild the whole system, essentially.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I'd also like to have Chuck Dayton speak.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dayton.
Chairman, members, Charles Dayton, I was a member of the MCAG, and I guess that's why I'm here, although I'm also a volunteer for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. This is something that can be done that lays the foundation for future action. Can be done this year. It's not hugely expensive, and it's the first step in whatever direction future climate regulation takes. If you go with a cap and trade system, you need this information. If you go with a carbon tax system, you need this information. You need to know where the emissions are. And so it's something that can be done as a foundation, as a first step. If we don't do it now, it will delay action in the future because the emitters will say, well, you can't do it until you have the data. And that seems to be a mantra. So this is important to get done. We don't know what's going to happen on the federal level. It may happen, but it probably will take till about 2013 before something is actually going on that level. So this is a start that will create an advantage, a leg up for the state. The language of the recommendation of MCAG is instructive, and it says the elements are the foundation of a climate action program in Minnesota, the foundation. So that's what we're talking about here, the foundation, this information. It would help position Minnesota entities for participation in an emissions trading program, and it's a precursor for sources to participate in greenhouse gas reduction programs, opportunities for recognition, and a greenhouse gas emission reduction registry, as well as to secure baseline protection, that is, credit for early reduction. One of the things of a cap-and-trade system is that if you reduce your emissions, you can get credit for that. Sometimes you can sell that credit to somebody who needs to emit more than they can reduce. How do you measure that unless you know what the baseline was? So there is a voluntary system in place now. It's called the Climate Registry. Minnesota companies can report to that if they choose to do so. There are only three real emitters that have chosen to do that. There are 13 overall. The three are Xcel, Minnesota Power, and Great River Energy. The rest are either St. Olaf and the Met Council and the PCA and a few environmental consulting firms. So I think it's important that it be a required reporting. I want to dispel some thoughts that or concerns that may have been raised about reports from homes or from farms and so forth. The way this is done is through the upstream provider. If you're going to look at what the emissions are from the natural gas burned in homes in St. Paul, you go upstream to the provider of the natural gas. If you're going to look at transportation, you go to the refinery. If you're going to look at agricultural emissions from nitrogen fertilizers, you go to the people who provide the fertilizer. You're not going to be requiring reports from individual homeowners, truck drivers, and so forth. So it has to be done in a way that is manageable. The bill gives the PCA great flexibility, I think, in how it is set up and in setting the thresholds for reporting. The typical threshold, and there are about 16 states that are doing this on a mandatory basis already, is 10,000 tons of direct or indirect emissions a year. That may or may not be an appropriate threshold in Minnesota. Massachusetts uses a 5,000-ton threshold, but the bill doesn't attempt to set the threshold. It leaves that to the agency. That's all I had to say.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dayton. I like that explanation. That clarified a lot for me. I don't know, maybe we could simplify some of the language or get that in there so it
it comes out a little more strongly in the language that where that responsible party is, so to speak, like we've been hearing on the low carbon fuels, that we're not going to every household, every building, but we're going upstream like that. I appreciate that. Senator Prettner-Solon. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Chair, Mr. Dayton,
I'm trying to understand. You mentioned the voluntary reporting, and maybe this is also a question for, or maybe a better question for Mr. Thornton, but prior to my retirement in November, I completed a greenhouse gas survey of sorts that was due in November for my company. What was that in deference to this? And it went to PCA.
Is that your thing?
Here comes me. Assistant Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sintrom, could that perhaps have been our attempt to inventory high potential greenhouse gases such as refrigerants and other items?
Mr. Chair, it was, yes.
That is a bill that was passed last year.
Okay.
And that was the first inventory of its type. And we had some problems in implementing it. And there's a report to the legislature that I just signed off on today that should be coming out any day now. But we would want to try to capture those kinds of emissions as well in a comprehensive greenhouse gas emission inventory. The question is how best to do it so that it's not too much of a burden for the people reporting or using those gases, and it's manageable for us on our end of things as well. So as Mr. Dayton indicated, there's ways of doing this that are easy, and there's ways of doing this that are maybe not so easy, and we need to sort all of this out and come up with a good approach.
Senator Sundjum.
And Mr. Thornton, so this particular piece of legislation would then include information such as I did report, many others did too, I suspect, plus some additional information beyond the so-called high potential greenhouse gases. Is that correct?
Assistant Commissioner. Senator Sintrom, yes. We would want to, the high potential greenhouse gases are just one subset of the total greenhouse gas emission picture. We would also want to get information about energy use at your facilities, mm-hmm. as well as transportation-related emissions. There are different ways about going about doing that. As Mr. Dayton indicated, we could get your energy use from the gas company,
mm-hmm.
and we could get your transportation fuel use in a number of different ways that would not mean that you have to report all of that. And so we need to sort out what's the most appropriate way of doing that for different kinds of facilities and particularly, as Mr. Dayton indicated, that's not the kind of thing we want farms and homes to report, and we need to figure out how to deal with institutions and commercial buildings. I think that's the area that we need to spend more time thinking about.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundjum.
I don't want to drag this on too much, but as for instance, why don't I just go back home and say our Olmsted County waste energy facility, you know, obviously it's a waste energy facility, and it burns things and carbon dioxide comes off the stack and so on. Would we, under this bill then, reporting tons of carbon dioxide coming off the stack, is that, and that's doable, but is that what we would do?
Mr. Assistant Chairman, Commissioner, Senator.
Amongst other things?
Exactly.
Okay. One more then.
Senator Sundjum.
Thank you. Mr. Thornton, I think you're familiar with, SARA Title III and the Toxic Release Inventory Program and that reporting that institutions need to perform. And that's an inventory collection system of information on toxic compounds that people might use and emit to nature in some form or another. Why wouldn't we use that tool as opposed to it happens to be located in public safety unless it's been moved. Why wouldn't we use that tool instead of rather than in terms of collecting and processing the information as opposed to starting a new tool in the Pollution Control Agency?
Just in Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sinjum, we're going to need a new tool for a lot of this.
Okay.
You raise a good question, though. Is it possible that we could use the toxic release inventory for part of it? And I don't know, but it's something that we need to look at.
Okay.
Because
fair enough.
Our goal is not to duplicate effort.
Sure. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just to that point, I understand the toxic release inventory has a slightly different purpose, though. I think it's more about informing the immediate community about what's happening kind of in their midst rather than trying to do an aggregate measure of what's happening on a particular pollutant in the state.
Mr. Chair, can I just offer
informing those, Senator, local communities.
I was just suggesting the data collection tool, using that tool.
That might be useful.
Yeah, I understand the other. Yeah.
My question is, and I don't want to get too bogged down in the weeds because I think we'll learn more as the system is designed. But I'm just curious: are we reasonably confident that this system of reporting of data collection would give us a fairly complete picture of the greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, or would we also need to be stepping back and taking a look at kind of large-scale activities that are going on in Minnesota, maybe to gain a fuller picture that doesn't come directly from, you know, a point source, you know, facilities reporting. I mean, I understand that, you know, we're going to look at maybe their refineries and how much transportation fuel they're selling, and that might give us a surrogate measure of what we can expect coming from our transportation activities. But do we also then take a look at overall VMT and private automobiles and commercial fleets and transit and get some measure from that as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, that's exactly right. In fact, I believe that the inventory we have right now gives us a complete picture. It's just that we collected that information ourselves. People didn't report it to us. So, in the future, we would not be getting people drivers, for example, to report their miles traveled to us and how much gasoline they used. That's another that we'd have to use some estimating tools in order to get at a lot of those different things. But part of what we envision a greenhouse gas inventory would look like would be for at least some of the larger sources would actually have to be reporting their emissions to us. And we think that we'd be able to maintain a complete picture of the emissions, but we'd get more accurate information that way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. We may have some more questions, but we'll I think there was another testifier.
Mr.
Robertson. Welcome to the...
Unfortunately, I called him Mike Franklin, but it's Mike Robertson.
We have, Mr. Chairman, we have two mics at the chamber, and I'm the Robertson mic.
Well, welcome. It's good to
see
you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Robertson. I'm an environmental policy consultant to the Minnesota Chamber. I was a member of MCAG along with Chuck, served with him on the group that was working on this issue. I'm also a member of the Midwest Governors Association Advisory Group. We like the approach in Senator Pretner Solon's bill. We know that greenhouse gas emissions reporting is coming, and we think that this is a good way to approach it with regard to Minnesota. Our greatest concern is consistency with what may be coming from the federal level. And we know that the feds are working on this, the new EPA management, and I just heard today that we may be seeing some kind of a proposal on this within the next even 30 days or so. So I think going forward, putting this into the PCA and the process that's laid out in Senator Pretner Solon's bill is a good way to address this. And as we participate in that, we will be interested in making sure that we limit the cost of this and duplication and confusion that may occur if we diverge in some way from the federal, whatever may be coming from the federal side. So we look forward to working with the senator and others on this approach, and we think it's a good one for proceeding on this issue.
Thank
Thank you. It's good to hear. From what I heard, it sounds like that's what the PCA wants to do, too, is not duplicate, and probably they'll keep in touch with the feds to find out if there's any changes in their design as well. Is there any other questions for any of the testifiers, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I don't know if we've ever seen out of the gates without an amendment. Environmental community, the business community, the administration all agree on.
Oh. Well,
that's impressive.
Congratulations, Senator Pretner-Solon. Very good.
So, Mr. Chair, on that note, then I move that Senate file number 444 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Maybe it can set the tone for the whole bill, huh?
Mr. Chair.
So you'd like to just lay this over?
Okay.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention that you probably are aware this will have to go through the Finance Committee.
Yes.
So I don't just...
And that was a question I was going to ask Mr. Fuller before, whether we should send it through the Finance Committee and pull it back, or how we do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm the chair of the Finance Committee, so you can just ask me. My opinion is that it's part of the PCA's budget. It's going to take money to do this, and it has rulemaking. So it definitely has to go to the Finance Committee.
Yes.
I would request it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, my question was, though, whether we build our omnibus bill first and send the whole thing through, or whether we send it through and then ask it to come back to our committee. I don't know.
Yeah, that's up to you.
Well,
Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Fuller's telling me that this has to go on to local government or state and local government.
Rules, yeah.
For rulemaking?
Yeah. So
then I guess I'll recommend that it travel on its own route. Huh?
Recommend it pass and move on to state and local government?
Okay.
All right. Senator Pretner, Senator Anderson.
I mean, there's always a possibility you can send it back here after it goes through that, through the other policy committees and the Finance Committee. It's possible sometimes to separate out the policy and the money, but I guess it depends.
Okay.
Senator Pretner-Solon, I'm going to have
work with you.
Mr. Fuller just say a few things about what direction this should go.
Madam Chair, I mean, we should set an alarm, but, of course, you can just hold it on the floor if it goes separately and keep the concept in the committee and move it out. And, you know, so you'd still have the opportunity to move it out of this committee after it went through all the other committees if it got to the floor, or you could join it up on the floor. So there's a lot of options.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Mr. Chair, committee members, I apologize. I had intended to check these questions out before I brought it to the committee. But at this time, I would recommend that we, I would move that we, that Senate file number 444 be recommended to pass and re-referred to rules.
Okay.
State and local.
To state and local government.
State and local government for rules, yeah.
And on that motion, any questions? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
All right. That will adjourn, end our business today, and meeting is adjourned. Thank you.